Let's start with maybe your most recent album, Radio Dial. Tell us about that collection of songs and the title and how you came up with it and the music on the album.
Sure. That was the second record that I made after moving to New York. And so I released A Plea for Dreamland in 2009, which basically straddled my time in Boston, and when I moved to New York, I started writing a lot. And there were different kinds of songs. They were a bit more fictional and story related, and had some more characters running through the songs. And so that came out in 2009, and after that, I met my engineer, even for this current project, Miles Cherney, and Joel Arno, who played drums and co-produced A Plea for Dreamland. They both live in Brooklyn. And I began writing a new collection of songs, and had this idea that I wanted to make a really kind of like a bigger album. I wanted a real big sound to the record. And Joel and Miles had this new studio that they just opened in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and so we began doing demos for the record in February in 2011. We just did acoustic cuts of all the songs. I think we did about maybe 15 or 16 songs, and then we started cutting the record that summer. But for me, when you're writing a whole bunch of songs, it's like, it's not until, for me, I'm really starting to make the album that you start to see some themes or similarity, certain songs just going together, and you start to think more in terms of an album. It's hard for me, you know, when you start thinking of an album too early, it can kind of muck up the process a little bit. So a lot of this album for me was writing songs about where I grew up, and that's been even more so continued with this new project, which is really about growing up in small towns and the cycles of towns, and so the title Radio Dial comes from the song Home, which is the sixth track on the record. And I was really thinking a lot about just ideas of home, and at the time I got a hold of these old patents that my great grandfather had designed. He was an engineer. He immigrated from Italy, and he worked a factory job in the town that I was raised in, Hopedale. At the time, it was one of the largest textile mills in the world, and these were his patents that he created. And there was something about looking at them, and this, my grandfather coming over here when he was 17 with really nothing and building a life for himself with, that really meant a lot to me, and I came to see the music as my attempt in a different way to sort of build a life for me. So they're featured prominently on the cover of the record, and so that was sort of the anchor point of the record as far as like thematically bringing all the songs together.
Okay. So I definitely noticed, you know, you said you drew you talked about that record as being sort of a continuation of Plea for Dreamland. You have this real ability, and then you talked about the telling story and putting yourself down. You have this real ability to create, well, to tell stories, to sort of put yourself in another person's perspective and create something really vivid that brings something to life. How do you do that? Where do these stories come from, and what's your inspiration for them?
Oh, wow, thank you. You know, for me, I draw a lot of stuff, whatever's happening in my life, and ends up filtering through the writing. So a lot of stuff I kind of call from just what's going on with me, and sometimes when I start writing, I usually just start with like one idea, whether it's a musical idea or a lyrical idea, and then I try to just have fun with it, kind of work it on both sides of itself, and not think too much about where this is going to go or what this means. I very rarely sit down and say, I want to write a song about a jilted love relationship that has, like, I don't really work in that kind of macro sense. I usually get more excited about turns of the phrase or certain lines or cadences of words or the sounds of words. In that respect, it's kind of whimsically simplistic. It's just I like the way certain sounds sound. So certain songs, like on A Plea for Dreamland, there's a song, Mississippi Red, and that's a completely fictitious story. And then there's a song, Black Lights, on Radio Dial, that I was reading a lot about boxing when I was making that record, and in particular this book by Joyce Carol Oates called On Boxing. And she's amazing. You know Joyce Carol Oates? Very wonderful writer. She lives in Maine, and she's in a band with Stephen King, I've heard, which is pretty cool. But she has this amazing book about boxing and the process of boxing. And at one point she talks a lot about how people's perceptions of what it is to be a boxer are so different than the reality of it, because being a boxer, 99% of what you do is beneath the surface. It's a solitary activity that kind of culminates in a public spectacle. And I thought there was a lot of parallels with that in terms of being a writer, being a songwriter, being going on stage and playing songs. And so that idea was the catalyst for that song, but the actual details of the song aren't factual, if that makes sense.
So that Black Lights mostly came from the book, or did you have to do other research on that? I mean, it just seems so vivid and so evocative. I did wonder how much of it draws on experiences as a musician.
A lot of it does. I mean, you know, the Parlor Sessions was such an amazing tour for me because it was the first time I really toured with like a group of guys, a group of songwriters. My experience touring for the last 6 years has been just getting in the car by myself and driving, and that can be kind of a tough thing. That element, there's definitely that element in the song Black Lights of like, even if there's people watching what you're doing, it's still, even as you're working out the songs on stage, like if it's something that you're wrestling with, it's just like you and the song. And every room can be different, and there's the process of driving to the gig. Like, there's all the stuff that, like, is very much below the surface in terms of, like, how people relate to what you do as a songwriter that they don't have access to. And so for me, boxing is so far removed from what I do that, like, I couldn't possibly really understand what it would be like to be a fighter and have to compartmentalize yourself that way, being outside the ring and inside the ring. And so Black Lights, the title of that song actually came from an interview from the book where it's this interview with Muhammad Ali, and the interviewer asks him, how do you know you've been hurt? Like, how do you know when you've been hit that you've actually been hurt bad? And of course, Muhammad Ali says, well, I've never been hit that hard to know. But I've heard that you see black lights. And there was just something about that image of, like, getting hit in the head so hard that, like, the electrical synapses in your head are just firing. I remember writing that down. And I was in Houston playing a couple shows in Texas and visiting my older brother who lives down there, and I started writing the first verse of the song, not really knowing where it was going to go.
Yeah, it's a great song. I mean, there's a lot of good songs. Like, Hospital Shirts is another one. Where does that come from?
Well, that's the complete other end of the spectrum, where that song is like deeply personal for me. My cousin, who was my age, had leukemia, and it, you know, was very sudden.
How are you doing, guys?
Great. Doing good. And when something irrational like that happens, and you're feeling angry, and you're feeling scared and vulnerable, and you can't do anything about it, and he lived in Hollywood. He was a screenwriter at the time, a really talented scriptwriter. And you can't help but write about it. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was write that song, but I knew that I had, like, I knew that I had to do it to kind of come to terms with what was happening. And I knew I didn't. He was a real. He was like a prankster and a real brave. The first thing he did when he found out that he had leukemia was, his favorite movie was Taxi Driver, so he shaved in a mohawk like Travis Bickle. And I didn't want to write a kind of a maudlin, like, sad cancer song. I wanted to write a song about, you know, someone who was kind of a pain in the ass in the hospital, and someone who was showed their strength through their sense of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted it to be a song about life and not a song about, you know, kind of illness in this stale, inhuman way. And I'm really proud of that song. And I go through phases where I'll play it a lot, and then I don't want to play it. You know, so that song is very personal to me. And it's interesting, though, because that song, depending on the room, it can, like, the first line of the song is, I know you think I look handsome in my hospital shirt. It's actually about him talking to his mother, trying to cheer his mother up. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that line very often gets a laugh when I play it live, and that's something that I wasn't really expecting. But I also think that's kind of great. Like, you write this thing, and people's response to it is different, you know.
Yeah, I have to say, it's a song about, you know, as you just said, even before you know the details, it's a song about something that obviously is very serious and very, heavy in a way. And you know, one of the things I think is powerful about a lot of the songs is that you deal with these themes that are, you tell these stories that could very easily be very sentimental, and yet you avoid that, I think, and I think that's not easy to do. So.
Oh, thanks.
Good. I like this.
I tend to like, even in other songwriters that I listen to, like, I tend to like the sort of the details that aren't the go-to details. Like, I like very vivid writing, but I like it when it doesn't give you exactly what you're expecting. And I feel like sometimes the most compelling writing is focusing on details that can seem extraneous, you know. On the way up here, I was listening to this record by Travis Meadows called Killin' Uncle Buzzy. It's just an amazing album of this guy pulling himself out of alcoholism. I mean, and there's just certain lines in the song, like, you know, I sold old guitars to buy watered-down drugs. And, like, that's just a great line, you know? Not because it's the most poetic, but just it kind of makes you feel, you know, it's a real line, you know? And I think the biggest challenge for me is, like, when you're writing, is, like, you have these lines, and some of them you know are right, and then some just, like, bother you. And there's no, like, there's no gray area. It's either, like, that's not good enough. Like, that's not, you know.
Yeah. And then, so then, the previous album of Bleed for Dreamland, well, that's the song, Bleed for Dreamland. Tell us about that song.
That one was inspired by my first trip to Coney Island, which I had never been to, and I had no idea that, you get off the train in this sort of sprawling ghetto, and then there's an amusement park right in front of you. It's very cool thing. It's a weird. There's like, it sounds trite, but there's really no place like it. And I we had a great day there. It was totally bizarre and weird and fun. And I just remember the feeling of being there. And I wrote this song about. I wanted to write this song about how it's this kind of wounded place. And it's damaged. It's been through so much, and kind of write about these characters that, like, clearly it's not an ideal match, or it's like the burgeoning of this relationship that's probably not going to go anywhere, but it's kind of stuck in this magical place, and they're going to play skee ball, and they're going to drink brandy and wait till the park closes, It's like very small and insignificant, but it's also kind of beautiful in its own way. Sometimes with those songs, I like digging in and just having fun with thinking about, like, writing about skee ball and trying to, you know, roll for the hundreds, which I always try to do. You know, just fun, just have fun. I always write better when I'm having fun, you know.
It's a good song.
Oh, thanks. You know, certain songs you write and then you put away, and that's always one that I like to play. Even that's one of those songs where even if it's kind of a noisy room and I know it's not going to go over well, like, I still play it anyway, because it's just, you know, I like that song.
So that was, let's see, you released your first album in, 2003?
That was my first, like, official. I had a few little cassette tapes before that, but that was my first, like, first release. But it was actually, like, 4 or 5 years in the making. Yeah, 2003.
And you're working on a new one now. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a new batch of songs that... we started recording in early May, again working with Miles Turney and Joel Arno, and the three of us have been producing the record, and this time I was really interested in basically recording all the basics live, so we did all vocals live, playing together with the band, so we wanted to, you know, it's weird when you write these songs and most of what I do is traveling around and playing solo by myself, so it feels weird. I guess it took me some of my fifth try to realize this, but it feels weird to, like, be doing that, to be writing and playing that way, and then show up at a studio and overdub the guitars and go back in with the headphones and overdub the vocals. It just never sounds right. So this time I really wanted to make an honest record that just sounded like me, and so we recorded in May, and we're looking at like a winter release, maybe early next year. We're just entering the mixing phase, and I'm thrilled about the way it's sounding. There's some musicians on the record that I haven't worked with previously. This guy Alan Markley, who played keyboards, and there's a lot of old analog synths on the record, and a guitar player named Paul Orbell, who's based in Queens, and I'm just very excited about this batch of songs. I think even more than the other last couple records, like, they just feel like songs that even 30 years from now I could still play and they would feel like relevant, or they wouldn't feel like silly to be playing.
So what has been your arc of, because you talked about, I asked you about releasing that first record through, you talked about how these last two have more of a narrative feel, and what has been your arc as a songwriter? And how does this continue or change since 2003 too?
Yeah, wow. I think this album definitely pulls together a lot of disparate things that I love about music, and usually the artists that I really like people like Tom Waits, or you know, their albums can really run the gamut as far as what type of songs are on the album. Like his album Mule Variations, the song Filipino Box Spring Hog is on the same record as Hold On, which is the fact that those two songs can exist on the record is kind of exciting for me. So there's a lot of tracks on this new album that are heavily electric and very story-driven, but aren't necessarily like verse, chorus, verse, bridge format. And I think these songs are more focused on like kind of a narrative feeling, you know, wanting to like, there's one particular song called Set Me Free, which you may have heard, I think, when I played Harlow Sessions. It's basically just 15 straight verses, and it wasn't one that I wrote first, but it was definitely like the queen bee of songs that when I wrote it, it was very clear that like the other songs are kind of branches on this tree, like this was the main thing, and then the other songs were different ways of kind of talking about this idea. So as far as an arc, I think it's trimming some of the fat, and I think it's also trying to focus more on just trying to convey something that is like can be lasting for people. I know for me as a listener, the best thing in the world is when you hear a song or you hear someone play, and in your head there's a voice that just says like, I absolutely have to hear that again. I have to hear that again. And I want these, you know, this is not like a singular goal. I'm sure a lot of people want this, but I want these songs to kind of be like that. I don't want them to be kind of like captive in this sort of umbrella of like male singer songwriter. I play guitar and sing. I want them to kind of be a little more than that, you know.
So when did you first begin playing music? And
I started. Well, I've always been singing. I grew up singing, and I got a little starter guitar when I was about 12 years old, which was awesome. And I still have it. And I started taking guitar lessons. My parents were wonderful. They've always been really supportive. So I started taking guitar lessons, and high school had a high school band, like a rock band. And when I went off to college, you know, for me, I was always kind of an introverted kid, and I liked to, I loved stories, I loved reading. I've always loved writing, so it was a really good, avenue to kind of channel those things. And it doesn't really take much. Once you learn a few chords, you can start. You get the bug, and then you just, you know, you just find yourself doing it all the time. You just find yourself going, oh, that's a cool thing. Let me write that down. Oh, that's kind of neat. And so I would say I think I wrote my first song about my music teacher in high school, when I was maybe 15.
That's one of my favorite questions. So you wrote your first song about your music teacher?
Yeah, he was great. He really brought out the best in, you know, us kids, and then he you know, he was kind of too good to be working in this little public school. And he went off to California to pursue a professorship of music. But he used to put these shows on called Highlights, where they were like big band variety shows where, you know, you'd sing anything from like Harry Connick Jr. songs to kind of contemporary rock songs, and he'd arrange everything. the show was called Highlights, so that was the name of the song. It was Highlight. I wrote it for him leaving.
Wow. So, I guess that answers my question. So you wrote your first song in high school?
I think it was like ninth grade. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the first album, once I went away to college, when I was back for a week or was back for summer break, I would record what I had. So some of the songs on that album I wrote when I was still in high school. So it was definitely like my first crack at learning how to sing and record and what it means to have songs and how to put them on a record. So big learning, as every record is, it's just a big learning experience on how to best do that.
Tell us about the process of putting together, and you've self-released all of your albums, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about that process, and are you interested in, do you hope for a major label contract, or would that be sacrificing some independence that you don't want to sacrifice?
I don't really have any hopes for like a major label deal. It's not really something that I'm pursuing, and I guess with almost 10 years of operating as kind of a solo operation, I'm just geared to work a certain way. So even with booking or I think there's a lot of small labels where if something was a great fit, I think that would be a wonderful thing. But I think it comes down to whether it's the musicians you're working with or whomever in your life, it's really about the people, you know. I know a lot of people who have record deals and contracts and they've spent years getting out of them. I think that whole kind of hierarchy as far as like what's best for people is so nebulous now. Like, you know, you hear people say, oh, you just got to be in the right place at the right time. And it always makes me laugh when people say that, because it's like, it's really not true. You know, the musicians whose careers I've really envied or who are doing great, they're some of the smartest and most hardworking people I've ever seen. And they've spent years and decades doing this, you know. So this idea that some cigar-smoking fat cat in a double-breasted suit is going to see you in a club and make your dreams come true is just not, you know, for me, just, again, it's that difference between people's perceptions of what it is that you do and the reality of it, you know. And I also feel like you should just focus on what you can control, you know. You should just try to make your music as good as you can. But I also think my process is basically like, I don't like to make too many plans with a record until I basically have it in hand. Especially now in this sort of content-driven, like social media-driven world, like, you know, you're in a much better position having a record that's just about to come out than you are having just put out a record. Because after it's a month old, it's old for people. People are already asking you when your next one is coming out. So for me, it's more about just relationships that I've created over the years of great venues I'm very lucky to play at, Club Hasim and Burlap and Bean. So I like to have a record done and then basically have about a 4-month window where I can try to reach out and get it out there into the world, and if I'm lucky, have some people to listen to it and maybe write about it. But it's you know, when you're working all on your own, there's always stuff you can be doing. So you kind of drive yourself crazy with, I would love to pursue some licensing opportunities, but I gotta follow up with press releases for this tour, and I think learning how to sort of manage your priorities and not kind of not making your head not keep you know allowing your head to spin off the axle is important.
Yeah. I think that's you've touched on this question a little bit already, but your musical influences, who are they? You mentioned Tom Waits and others.
Yeah, I mean, there's the heavy hitters, obviously people like Tom Waits and Dylan and you know, but those are like...
That's right. As long as you're close to them, it probably picks up the mic.
Yeah, I mean, those are like, you can't do this job without those people being influences. I really love Gillian Welch. She's a writer who's, you know, she has those songs that just slay you. And she's one of those people that can just write a song that, you know, makes you want to lay in the street, and that's just bowls you over. So she's been, I love listening to her stuff and the way she sings, and I think even just the tempos of her songs. I went to school with Josh Ritter, and he's been a big influence on me, just in a lot of ways, really, and I've been fortunate enough to play with a lot of his bandmates, and they've all recorded on records of mine. And early on, Josh was a mentor. I'd be having trouble with something, and he'd be at the airport. I'd get to call him up on the phone, and he would help me through figuring out. So Josh, just in terms of his musicality and his song. But I also love, a lot of what I write about comes from just stuff that I'm reading, and I really love to read, and so that stuff really filters through a lot of the kind of like ideas for songs. I went through like a little bit of like a Norman Mailer kick, and that was reading The Execution of Song, and it's just this big long story about true to life story about this guy who was executed for these murders, and I think a lot of that starkness of it, of the narrative, you know, I think led to this song called Joplin that I wrote, that I've been playing quite a bit. That's going to be on the new record. But yeah, you know, I'm sort of a big, like, you know, a lot of the heavy hitters, Springsteen. But then even just in terms of the way people approach a song, like David Gray, a lot of the more contemporary people, I'm a big Joe Pug fan. But I've also been fortunate that I have a lot of friends of mine whose music I'm a huge fan of. Dietrich Strauss, who's a Boston songwriter, who is a good friend of mine and a great songwriter. Jake Hill, Julian Villard. And Nika Pauly, who I'm playing with tonight, she's fantastic.
What did you major in at Oberlin?
I was an English major.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, you were? Okay. And I did my thesis on Tom Waits' Mule Variations.
Wow.
Which was a whole lot of fun. And my advisor was a big Waits fan. This is pre-YouTube era, so like I was calling flea market people to get VHS tapes of like compilations of like Waits' Letterman performances and all this stuff. So I still have all these VHS tapes of like all this Waits footage that I use to sort of like. Now it's funny because now you just type in Tom Waits on YouTube and it's all right there.
So your songwriting process. Well, you talked more about the ideas, but. Yeah. So, from idea to sort of song, how does that work? You obviously put a lot of influence on lyrics. How does that get matched to the music? You draw on a lot of genres, really.
Yeah, you know, I really work on both together. I kind of chug along and you know, you have something that, you have an idea, or you have a chorus, or you have something that you know you like, or that sounds good, and really your job is to, like, not screw that up, really. That's really, like, and actually Dietrich once was explaining it, like, sometimes writing a song can feel like you're building something, you're putting some stuff together, but sometimes it can feel like you're kind of wiping stuff away, almost like an archaeologist, and your job is to, like, not kind of ruin what is there, you know, not overcomplicate anything, or not, and, you know, some of the, you know, like, a lot of Townes Van Zandt songs, there's the, you know, the kind of, like, the emotional, like, what the emotion is very simple, but the way he, there's something really extraordinary about the way he, you know, If I Needed You, which is one of the most popular songs, is a very, like, primal emotion, and he articulates it in this way that makes it so timeless, you know? So I don't think it has to be, like, as a songwriter, you have to be, like, there's not a whole lot of acrobatics involved. I think it's just, it's more about kind of, like, this balance between allowing yourself to be open enough to catch the ideas as they're coming to you, but also having your mind kind of keen to, like, an editing process to be able to sort of, like, make your way through it, so that, like you were talking about earlier, like, well, that line is a little predictable, or that line is a little too sentimental, like, I want to find, and usually, like, for me, it's like you have this feeling of what you want the line to do, and you're sort of chasing the feeling of it, you know, and you don't really know it until you get it, the line, you know, and that's sort of the same thing when you hear a songwriter do it. You know, Joe Pug is an example of that. You know, some of his lines, we're just like, man, like that. And it's almost like watching, like, an archer, where, and he hits that bull, like, shit, man, that's great. You know, because there were literally, like, 10 million different things he could have put there, but, like, that, you know. So I do think it's kind of like, you know, those people in New York who are, like, great speed chess players, and it's like, the game is the game, but, you know, someone's ability to just navigate that board is, like, just takes years of just knowing what it is, you know. And I think that's the same, that's the thing that I like about it. I like learning about other people's disciplines and how it relates, because there's a craft to it, like, whether it's chess or making food. It's not like good food is, like, stuff you've never eaten before in your life. It's just execution is what's usually more important than, like, originality, you know. Writing a song about this crazy idea that nobody, you know, you don't have to do that. Like, you don't have to strive for that. You could just write something that is a universal feeling in a way. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Tom Waits, but his Picture in a Frame song, you know, it's this beautiful love song just about, you know, the sun come up, it was blue and gold ever since I put your picture in a frame. Like, everybody knows what that means, but it's just such a neat way of being like, man, like, you know, that's just a